He was described by one of his patients as compassionate, conscientious, and a caring physician. He worked for 8 years at Swedish Hospital in Seattle, Washington, but wanted more quality time with his patients. During the COVID pandemic, he opened his own practice, 360 Osteopathy. Dr. West gives us his take on working for a hospital system versus working for himself, the challenges and the benefits. He is a physiatrist whose practice is 99% OMM. He spent some time comparing and contrasting PM&R and OMM, which may be beneficial for students deciding between these two specialties. He also gives some incredible book and podcast recommendations. Enjoy our conversation. This is episode 92 of the Osteopathic Manipulative Medicine Podcast, where we share clinical stories and pearls related to osteopathic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ben Green, a third-year osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine resident at Michigan State University. Our guest is board-certified in physical medicine and rehabilitation, as well as osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine. He completed residency at Rush Medical Center in physiatry, focusing on patients recovering from strokes, amputations, traumatic brain injuries, and spinal cord injuries. He completed a second residency in ONMM at Pikeville Medical Center with Drs. Ed Stiles, Jennifer Kingery, and Laura Griffin. He has numerous presentations on topics such as rehabilitation and yoga, and another being temporal mandibular dysfunction and treatment with manual therapies. He treats patients of all ages, but has a particular interest in treating infants with osteopathic manipulation. He worked at Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, Washington for 8 years before opening up his own successful practice, 360 Osteopathy, during the COVID pandemic. We welcome to the podcast, Dr. Tony West, DO.
Hi, Ben.
Hey, Dr. West. Thanks for coming on tonight. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start the podcast out getting to know you, and it's maybe the most difficult question. If you had to describe yourself in a sentence or two, how would you do that?
So I've worked on practice this today with a patient, and
okay,
she wanted to comment that I was a compassionate, conscientious, caring person. I believe that our main pursuit in life should be our health, because it's actually our greatest asset. And especially since leaving Swedish, I've worked a lot to really hone my OMT skills and continue to do so, and feel pretty confident in helping patients pursue health and healthy choices.
That's great. So a patient called you compassionate, do you say conscientious or?
Yeah.
Conscientious and caring.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen a lot of people who are just very wonderful patient pool. My patients, a lot of them have been, or a lot of them are successful professionals. And this patient that helped me think about that statement is, you know, was a vice president in human resources at a very large company based here in Seattle. So it's nice when your patients have such a good rapport with me, and nice when my patients think so highly of me.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's got to be one of the perks of having your own practice, being able to dictate how much time you spend with each patient.
It is probably one of the best perks. I think time as a physician is one of our most valuable resources. So being able to spend the extra time with patients is, it's really the way I wanted to practice medicine. It's not the working with patients for 5 or 10 minutes and then moving on. That's spending an hour to 45 minutes with my patients.
Right. And I'm sure, you know, that patient population that you're working with that are, I'm guessing, very health conscious, want to really take care of themselves and looking to optimize their health.
They are
probably, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, they are very health conscious, but a lot of them have, a lot of people that end up in, you know, the office of someone that practices musculoskeletal care like I do, they're desperate. They've seen physical therapists, massage therapists, chiropractors, you know, a number of physicians, and have been frustrated by not being listened to by the, you know, the other physicians that they've worked with. I hear almost every day from new patients that they are just really frustrated that the physicians don't have time to listen to them. And what's really nice is that patients are very compassionate and understanding about that. They say, I know the hospital is dictating the rules. We know the insurance companies are saying that we need to move along and, you know, move patients through faster. Because the physicians very typically want to spend enough time to really practice care in a conscientious, compassionate way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Time is probably for us as human beings our greatest commodity, and especially in healthcare, being able to spend quality time with your patients where you're not looking at your watch or typing frantically so you don't have 50 notes at the end of the day is so beneficial for their overall health. And I think, like you said, that rapport, establishing that rapport with the patient, which I think is so key to them buying into what the words that you're saying, trusting you, believing in your competency, and adhering to your recommendations. So yeah, that's great. I'm happy for you. I wish I aspire to have a practice like that in the future as well, where I don't feel all these pressures to just move through patients one after another.
Actually, just as you mentioned, the, you know, 15 patients a day and having the stack of notes on your desk at the end of the day, that was my life for the first 4 or 5 years after residency. I don't miss it.
I bet not.
So
I bet not. I think there are some physicians who thrive in that environment. I'm not one of them.
Yeah, I'm not either.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, thanks for sharing that. Let's move on to, I'm interested in this, a movie or documentary recommendation.
Oh, I am not sure. I, you know, one thing that, one documentary that kind of stands out to me, I believe the name of it was Thrive the Movement.
And okay.
It was a friend, and it's a little bit of conspiracy theory type of thing, but it was actually produced by one of the heirs of the Procter Gamble dynasty or family, I guess you would say. And he really wanted to help bring fresh water to poor countries, but you really have to be able to have a lot of electricity or, you know, power. And and so watching that movie kind of helped me really understand that a lot of the, you know, more than likely a lot of the people who are controlling the assets in the world, like the oil especially, they're not terribly interested in helping the masses. They're kind of really trying to muster as many resources as they can to protect them and their families. It's a very interesting thing. And and made me think a lot about the hospital systems, how the hospital systems are really not geared to support physicians, but really just to kind of grind through them. Administration has its own agenda separate from patient care, and it's really all about finances. So,
gosh, yeah.
I feel like that's very dark to say. that was my experience. So,
yeah. Yeah. And I've talked to a number of physicians who have mentioned that as well. So was this the documentary Thrive, What on Earth Will It Take, that came out in 2011?
I think so. That sounds right.
Okay. Okay. It's going on the list of documentaries to watch. I think, yes,
you
going
know, the
back.
Another documentary that I really love is there's a series on Netflix called Babies. And I feel for new parents, not enough people know about this series, but it's called Babies. And it really talks about breastfeeding, gestation, you know, the birth, the bonding of the infant with the parents, whether the biological parents or not. Really powerful, powerful documentary. So, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, and on Netflix as well is, you know, there's a lot of really good, they're very short. And the name of it is How Things Work. But that's a great series. If you guys haven't watched that, it's a really, really good number of short videos on that.
Yes, I love that series.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. Thanks for sharing those.
Sure.
What about a book recommendation?
Well, you gave me those list of questions, so I have a list of books. So first and foremost, I will say that I have all the med students that rotate with me now. I have them read What Happened to You by Oprah and Dr. Bruce Perry. And
hey, when I rotated with you, you didn't have me read that.
Right. You were with me in 2 days. And this book was just published like maybe earlier this year. But yeah, Bruce Perry worked at, I think, Chicago University at, or University of Chicago. I think it was University of Chicago. And he was an MD PhD, or is an MD PhD. He did his residency in psychiatry and his PhD in neuroscience. He's brilliant. And so if you really want to understand the some of the how the brain maps or why it maps a certain way, this book, What Happened to You, by Oprah and Bruce Perry is great. Bruce Perry is one of the world's foremost trauma experts. Mm-hmm. And I love that book. So I have my students read that. Previously, I had them read White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. She's a professor here at University of Washington. And it's White Fragility is really talking about how our society, our culture is very segmented by race and economic status. And to this, you know, it's still, you know, your zip code determines how much trauma you grow up with or grow up around. It's amazing how zip codes have that much determination of what kind of life you're going to have. And I think that's kind of sad in one of the wealthiest countries, if not the wealthiest country of the world. But that really starting to understand the disparity between different cultures here in our own country. But since this book was released, Outlive by Peter Attia, this is an amazing book. If you haven't read it or you don't know of Peter Attia's podcast, The Drive, have you read Outlive?
I haven't read Outlive. I've listened to a lot of Peter Attia. I'm a huge fan of Peter Attia.
Right.
So I will definitely be reading that book in the near future.
So, yeah, and he talks about the four horsemen and the four horsemen that he calls neurodegenerative diseases, metabolic diseases, cardiovascular disease, and, oh, gosh, cancer. So, and how really all of them, there's so many links to diet and exercise. And the better your diet and exercise, the higher chance of good health that you will have. And even for, you know, of course, cancer can have a very strong correlation with genetics, and they all can have a strong correlation with genetics, but diet and exercise are really powerful ways to help move those along, or to help manage those or treat them even. And so, yeah, Peter has looked at what helps longevity in our life, and he's brilliant. He's taken and distilled down all the things I think, or many of the things that I wanted to know about as a medical student. And mm-hmm. in medicine, we're learning so much about all the red flags of disease, which is great. That's stuff we need to know. But Peter, this book really distills down like all those things about how what we need to do and how we need to be healthy. Because health, like I said earlier, I think is our greatest asset. So yeah. So those are some of them. And then the last one I'm reading right now is called Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And this book is from a Native American perspective or indigenous population of being integrated or involved with our physical natural environment. And it's really about gratitude and having a practice of gratitude, which I think is really important for health and happiness. So
yeah, and you live in a privileged place, Dr. West.
I do.
You appreciate the natural beauty.
I do, yes. Yeah. So
yeah, that's great. That is great. I love those recommendations. I really, really appreciate those recommendations. You know, talking about Peter Attia, he actually did an Instagram video where he's promoting it might be called the longevity calendar or a life calendar.
Is that where it shows the remaining weeks of your life?
Yeah. So you put it in a place in your house and, you know, you project how long you think you're going to live. And at the end of each week, you know, it's this calendar with dots that represent a week all the way until the black dot, which represents your death. And then each week that goes by, you just fill in or cross out an X, and it gives you the sense that, you know, again, going back to the theme of time is truly a precious commodity that, you know, maybe we shouldn't take it for granted, but we should really live in the present moment with an attitude of gratitude. I think he's so insightful, the things that he says.
Right. If you listen to Peter, you probably listen to Andrew Huberman as well.
Oh, absolutely. And Rich Roll.
Yeah.
Rich Roll as well. Mm-hmm.
But Andrew Huberman in one of his most recent podcasts is talking with Paul Conte, who I believe is a psychiatrist. And Paul Conte really kind of distills down that happiness is two things. One, a sense of agency, like someone who opened up their private practice. And then two, a sense of gratitude, of being grateful for, you know, what you have. That is what he, how he distilled down happiness. I thought that was really powerful.
Agency and gratitude.
Yeah.
Can you develop a little bit more what you mean by agency?
Oh, sure. Agency is, it's kind of control over your life and your decisions. So some people feel really driven by events in their life. And sometimes that feeling of being driven is more a result of negative thinking or superstitious thinking, or you know, past tendencies or history of trauma. And so when you are able to recognize those areas of past trauma or those patterns in your life and interrupt those patterns, you have more agency in your life.
Yeah.
And so when you have more agency, you in essence have more control, not over just kind of like your day-to-day decisions. Well, yes, to your day-to-day decisions, but you also have awareness of some of your patterns, and you can say, this is a pattern I want to maintain, and or this is not a pattern I want to maintain. And really, you gain more agency through, in my mind, self-reflection, work with therapists, meditation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I would add to that sense of time as well. It's kind of, I guess, rising, would you say, one's the locus of control versus victimhood? Is that fair?
I would say, yeah, there's a lot more awareness mm-hmm. versus being driven by a feeling of being the victim. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, going back to Peter Attia, this guy, he swam the channel between Maui and, why am I blanking on, Lanai, I think they call it.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and then I believe he swam from Maui, the Molokai channel, Maui to Molokai.
Oh, awesome.
And I think he may have done it at nighttime. You know, this guy's like, he's like next level.
It's a little crazy. Some things that he does. I think that's a little crazy. I mean, sometimes, I don't know, it's way beyond my comfort zone. Good for him, but way beyond my comfort zone. And I am an excellent swimmer, but I don't know. It's like open water at night, not my thing.
Yeah, in the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah. Waves. Anyway, that was great, Dr. West. I absolutely love these recommendations, and I'm definitely going to read them. Moving on to your career story. Why medicine? Why did you decide to do medicine?
Honestly, the long answer is I was a theater major, and I thought I would want to do acting. But I didn't feel confident about pursuing it yet. So I decided I would pursue optometry, and have that kind of as a backup plan. And then maybe work at Costco as an optometrist in LA while I was pursuing acting. And then along the way, one of my, professors just felt like I was really good at it. And she said, you know, you should just go to medical school. And it wasn't something I'd ever really thought about. And so I did. I shifted my focus and took the MCAT and applied, and there it happened.
Got in. So nobody in your family were medical physicians?
No.
Wow. Okay. And any particular reason, osteopathic school?
So when I was living here in Seattle, I met a friend of a friend who was a pre-med advisor at University of Washington. And he was the one that, you know, had me come into his office and then handed me a book on osteopathic medicine and DOs. And I read the book when I was on the plane. I didn't even remember where I was going. And I just really felt like that was a good fit. So, yeah.
Wow, a pre-med advisor at UW, which is like the most allopathic school.
Yeah, it is very allopathic. It's very, yeah. So,
wow, So why? Why did this pre-med advisor give you a book on osteopathy versus MD school?
So, he was savvy. He said that a lot of students, I was in my late 20s or early 30s when I met him, and he just knew that osteopathic schools took students with more life experiences typically. And so that was what his recommendation was. So, and also getting to know me, he also understood that I was very interested in just health in general and pursuing health. And he had a really good understanding that that was much more osteopathic than allopathic. The allopathic is not always about health. It really is much more about disease. And sometimes I feel, sometimes the allopathic students are not going in to medicine as much to help people as they are for other reasons. And so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of like soldiers fighting disease all the time, putting out fires.
Kind of. But also, I would say some we all have different things we gain from a career in medicine. Being a doctor, there is a prestige associated with it. And, there's that ego can be a part of it. And finances, people's wanting to, make a lot of money, and different specialties definitely attract different people for different reasons. But for me, it was always about helping people.
And where does that come from? That desire to help people? Is that something that you saw role modeled in your parents or a mentor?
I think it probably comes a little bit from my parents, but mostly my mom. And I think my teachers, always have an appreciation for my teachers of how they had to give us homework and assignments. It was for our benefit, even when we hated it. And it's kind of interesting that working with my patients, sometimes they experience discomfort, but yet when they leave, they're feeling much better. And same with homework for me. I hated homework. always a struggle. And so, yeah, I think a lot of it is probably from the role modeling of my teachers and definitely my mom. I grew up on a small farm in Indiana. So, if you didn't take care of the animals, they just suffered. And so helping other creatures avoid suffering was important to me.
I see. So you were very, very sensitive from a pretty young age.
Yeah.
Okay. How did you end up in Seattle all the way from Indiana?
Sometimes we say things that get us a little bit, end up with a surprise. So I was at Indiana University, and two of my friends were driving out to Seattle for spring break. And so they were going to spend 3 days in the car each way, and then 3 days here in Seattle. And it didn't sound very exciting to me. I'd never really done a car trip like that. to spend 6 days sitting, which sounded horrible to me. And I said, what are you going to do in Seattle for 3 days that's going to make all this worth it? And they said, we're going to look for a job. And I just was like shocked. I was like, if you find a job in 3 days, I will move out there with you. And I did not know and was not told that my friend Erica, she had 9 interviews set up during those 3 days. So I kind of got, bamboozled a little bit. I actually didn't find out that she had those 9 interviews set up until her 50th birthday party a couple years ago. And I was chatting with her cousin at her birthday party. And she's like, oh yeah, Erica had 9 interviews set up. And I was like, what? How come I never knew about that? So.
But you were true to your word, huh? So
I did.
You got a job out there and you're like, okay, well, I got to move out there now.
Yeah. And, you know, it all worked.
And there you are to this day. So you must love it.
I do. I still love it. And I think sometimes we really underestimate ourselves. There's a lot more opportunity, or at least there used to be. I don't know what it's like now, but I think having a sense of adventure and courage to just pursue it. Most of us have support families that are supportive enough that if we fall, they'll help us pick us back up. And I think in my journey here, one of the things I've learned about white culture is a sense of perfection, and that as the white culture really pushes us to be perfect and do things right the first time. Other cultures are not like that, and allowing yourself failure is important. It's also one of the most educational opportunities you can ever give yourself. It sounds silly and crazy, but failure is a powerful way to learn.
Absolutely. It's tough. It's like tough love, you know?
It is.
Nobody wants to fail, but when you're honest with yourself, you're right. You can learn so, so much from failing.
Yeah.
Okay. So going back to medical school, so you get into osteopathic medical school. You went to PCOM in Pomona. I'm sorry.
It's actually called Western. Comp. Yeah, Western. It's called Comp. C-O-M-P. Yeah.
And what was your experience like there with the osteopathic principles and practice class? Did that resonate with you?
It did. I really liked it. And I had a lot of great interactions with my classmates. I just pretty quickly had a natural talent for finding and working with the osteopathic lesions. And, helping people feel better. So more soft tissue and myofascial release and, you know, strain counter strain is amazing. So I got a lot of really good experiences there. I did I was a TA for my second year, one of the teaching assistants, and I enjoyed that. And I chose not to pursue or apply for the undergraduate fellowship. And I did that because I was an older student and I felt pressured to kind of be done with school and move on and go towards residency. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any advice for third and fourth year medical students who are in the hospital setting that want to do OMT, but don't really know how to present it to their attendings? Do you have any tips or advice? Both MD and DO attendings.
So I found lots of opportunities to work with DO attendings, and a lot of the DO attendings were more than happy to allow me to practice my skills with their patients. And sometimes I would be given an extra exam room for patients who had a lot of neck pain, and I'd go in the room and spend an hour in there working on the patient. It was a great experience for me and a good experience, you know, and nice for the patients because often they left feeling better. With the MDs, I can't really think. My OB attending, she let me do osteopathic treatment on patients at times. And so if you're doing it in those settings, do stick to gentle techniques. Don't risk HVLA techniques. Do very gentle things that even if it doesn't work at all, it's not going to cause the patient any harm. So, yeah. Because you don't want, you certainly don't want to compromise your preceptor. You want to make sure that they can feel confident that you're going to make good choices. So that's important.
Yeah, especially when you're still learning. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we're always still learning, but yeah. When it's not your license, when it's someone else's license, be extra careful.
Yes, good advice. So going to the end of third year, beginning of fourth year, how did you choose physiatry?
You know, once I was chatting with a classmate and we were both looking at doing a residency that involved hands-on and musculoskeletal practice like sports medicine. And he talked about physiatry. And he was actually rotating with a physiatrist here in Seattle. And I worked with one down in Puyallup shortly there afterwards. And so, you know, physiatry, we learn a lot about electrodiagnostics, which helps with, you know, understanding how the nerves are working with the muscles. But you have to know anatomy, and you also just learn a ton about the musculoskeletal system. So it was a really good blending of being able to do, learn a lot about the musculoskeletal system, and then still consider doing an OMM practice. And really, as I progressed through my third and fourth year, I really wanted to do a physiatry, work in a physiatry practice, and do OMT in a physiatry practice for the other physiatrists, which is what I did at Swedish for 8 years. It was not the working with you. It was working with those other physicians was amazing. And I worked with some of the best physicians. I'm so grateful that I got to work with a lot of those doctors there. It was, you know, just more the hospital system, but the practice itself was amazing. And so as a medical student, knowing, I just knew what I wanted to do. And I followed my heart, really, of wanting to do musculoskeletal care.
I see. Yeah, you worked with Dr. David Claussen, one of the physiatrists that I worked with when I was working through Swedish Hospital, who's an incredible physiatrist.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, the stars have aligned here because I have a Zoom meeting with the students from the SAO throughout the country. And the topic of the conversation is to compare and contrast physiatry and ONMM, because there are a number of students who aren't sure, should I become a physiatrist or should I become an ONMM specialist? How would you compare, how would you contrast them, and what advice would you give to students going through this dilemma?
Wow. So for me, one of the things about medicine that I think is important is the age that you enter into medicine. And so for me, I was in my 30s when I went to medical school. But even so, doing the exact same thing for 30 to 40 years can be challenging in my mind. And so what I liked about physiatry was that you can subspecialize in physiatry in so many different ways. You can focus on traumatic brain injury. You can focus on spinal cord. You can focus on amputation. And those can all be, you can do just those. You can do sports medicine. You can do injections. You can do ultrasound. And ultrasound is huge right now. And I love ultrasound because it's really where, you know, we can do live, you know, interactive motions under ultrasound to see moving tendons and moving tissue. and we're gaining so much information and knowledge about treating patients with that. Of course, that leads to a lot of injections. So you can kind of learn different areas of physiatry and shift kind of your specialty. You can also do inpatient. I always forget about inpatient. That was never something I was super excited about, but you know, treating patients in the hospital or out the hospital and specializing in different types of care. I think also, because I did the plus one, I didn't do the full 3-year residency for NMM. I'm not sure about what they do in the first, you know, and as their internship, but I really also appreciated that in physiatry, it felt like I was much more part of the inpatient community if I wanted to be. For osteopathic, it's very much, it's outpatient. Right now, there's a couple institutions that do inpatient, but not as many, and there's not as many jobs for that. And so kind of what are you going to look for in your life later on? Is the inpatient setting something you really want? I think physiatry is probably the way to go. But there are more and more, there's a few inpatient OMT places. One in San Diego, your institution probably, Barnabas. Mm-hmm. The other thing is having the ability to understand electrodiagnostics, which I think are a very powerful way of understanding how muscles and nerves are interacting and talking to each other. I think that's also really helpful. Gives you a lot more objective findings. And I think it's nice to have training in something that does very objective findings. And I don't want to discount the findings that someone in doing OMT finds, because I can palpate it. I can show my students, you know, so this is the tissue texture change I feel. This is the, you know, facet that I feel is not working well. This is the joint that needs help. This fascial restriction needs to be released here. That's very objective findings too. It's a little bit softer diagnoses. It's very different to say, you know, L5 was flexor rotated side bent right, than it is to say, you know, you have a ulnar neuropathy and it's, you know, entrapped and the pronator teres, and we need to release the pronator teres to help that ulnar entrapment, or actually median nerve entrapment. I'm sorry. So I like having the extra clinical acumen to diagnose musculoskeletal pieces from that I learned during my physiatry residency. So yeah.
Okay. It's helpful. I appreciate that.
But to be honest, I use OMT all the time. That's what I do. And I love it. And my patients love it. It's one thing for them to get a diagnosis. It's another thing for them to walk out feeling better. And physiatry doesn't offer that as much as OMT. But the lens of looking, being able to look through both lenses, I just really like that for me. That is something that I really like. But what do I do 99% of the time? I do manipulation and have great success with it. And my patients love it. So yeah.
And how did you evolve into primarily doing osteopathic manipulation? Because are you still doing EMGs and?
No, really, I haven't done any since residency. How did I evolve? I really just, that's kind of what, when I was hired at Swedish, that's the job they wanted me to do, was manipulation, and I just modified Well, I didn't modify. I just kind of, those were the patients I attracted. And it didn't take long. My practice filled within 6 months. And I was full. So, and that was just for manipulation. So they didn't need me to do EMGs. They had plenty of other providers that could do that, but only I could do the manipulation in the system.
Got it. And it was just very rewarding for you, such that, I mean, you started your own practice.
Yes. During the
pandemic.
Right.
Can you talk to us a little bit about, you already mentioned it, but why you went from Swedish to your own practice and what you love about your practice?
Yeah, you bet. So during the pandemic, I actually had just gotten back from convocation, and they decided that they were going to close our practice because we were not essential. And at the beginning of the pandemic, they didn't want to be spreading anything. They didn't want the employees to get sick. And so they really just dropped the staff down to a skeleton crew. And they said, told the physicians, you know, we're managing chronic pain. A lot of this can be, doesn't need to be, is not urgent. So let's, they just shut us down. And for 2 months, I would go into work for about an hour a day, answer emails. Then I'd come home and walk the dogs for, you know, 3-4 hours. Then I'd make a really nice dinner, and I just really enjoyed myself. I started sleeping better. My health got so much better because I wasn't driving myself into the ground all the time. When they ramped us back up to 80%, I was like, oh, this is good. I could do this for 20 more years. And then they ramped us back up to 100%. And that extra 20% made a huge difference. And I was like, I can't do this for another 20 years. And so that was when I kind of started looking at options. There was a really good physical therapy group that worked closely with our practice. And they just kept saying, hinting, oh, you know, hey, Tony, there's an office space available in the same building that we're in. And it's just right across the hall from us. And it's be perfect size for, you know, one or two doctors to work there. And so I called the office managers and rented an office. I signed my lease in July of 2020. And then I left Swedish in September of 2020. And then I opened at the end of October. I had taken a trip and I kept getting calls while I was kind of isolating after my trip about, hey, Dr. West, when are you going to open? And so then I just was like, oh, I'll just go in and see a couple patients. Well, it actually never stopped. So a couple patients, and then it just starting the last week of October of 2020, and I just kept going.
Were these patients that followed you from Swedish?
Some of them were, and some of them were referred by the lactation nurses in the area because people were still having babies. And, you know, those babies still need to be treated. And so, yeah. And so, yeah, just learned all. It's a little bit of a steep learning curve, but actually one of my former colleagues really coached me through it. And so he showed me how to do a business plan and, you know, all the licenses I needed, and just really helped me out.
Oh, that was huge, I bet.
It was huge. So, yeah.
Because I can imagine, you know, I'm thinking about myself. I have no experience with opening a business or studying business, keeping books, licensing.
Exactly. It's daunting. You know, chiropractors, half of their education is how to run a business.
Right.
And that we don't get any of that. My conspiracy side would say that that's to help the system control doctors. Because in essence, doctors are really smart. They don't want people who are thinking. They want people who are too busy to find new solutions. That's my bias. But yeah, so it was a steep learning curve, but luckily I had friends who knew how to do it.
Yeah, that's awesome. What a great gift.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us just maybe a little bit about what you love about the practice, and maybe some things that are a little more trying? I guess the pros and the cons. A few.
The cons, I'll start with that. So, not being affiliated with a larger institution right now. I think sometimes that I don't actually really miss that most of the time. But every once in a while, it's nice to have a colleague around. But even so, if you've worked in a hospital, probably even during residency, your colleagues are so busy, they don't always have time to talk to you. There were days where I would be in my office and I would only see my office partner for 5 minutes because we were both in the exam room so much. So the other thing is just kind of not having someone else kind of double check me. So, did I get my business license? Did I get my DEA license? Did I get my physician license? Did I pay my taxes? I do have a bookkeeper and they actually do help a lot, but all the little things that I need to do to maintain my license, my medical license, is all my responsibility. At the hospital, they had checks. You know, the administrators would usually say, hey, your license is due to expire. You need to fill out this paperwork. So sometimes they just kind of fed it to you. But even then, I felt like even at Swedish, they were very lackadaisical about it. Mm-hmm. The pros, I set my own hours. If I want to work on the weekends, I can, which I do because it's helpful to my patients. Sometimes my patients need flexibility in their schedule. And I have one patient that has a very busy job during the week. She doesn't work on the weekends, but she feels guilty and even more stressed if she has to miss time at work during the week. So when I was seeing her much more regularly, I would see her on Saturdays. And now I just see her, I see her less frequently. So I have moved her to just once during the week. So there's that. The positive also just spending more time with patients, getting to know my patients better, really, making sure they're satisfied, you know, being flexible. I've had a couple patients show up and, or just need to reschedule or cancel at the last minute. And just being able to be generous and flexible. People are under a lot of stress. And I think, you know, when you're trying to help them find health, adding to that stress is kind of counterproductive. And so the more flexible I can be and patient and with scheduling, I think that it really helps them feel supported so that they feel like they have, you know, a better connection with someone who is working with them when they're feeling so damaged and vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I can understand how city life, I mean, even just maybe the morning commute to work, you know, would be quite stressful in Seattle.
It can be. Yeah. But I work two blocks, so I walk two blocks to work. So that's my commute.
Yeah, you're not one of the unfortunate ones commuting in from Puyallup to downtown Seattle, you know, 2 hours every day.
Right. That is not my life.
Yeah.
Anymore.
So talking about OMT, you know, you started your osteopathic practice. You did a second residency at Pikeville. And so I'm going a little bit back in time. Why did you choose to do a second residency? And what were some of your big takeaways from that second residency in ONMM?
So I did the second residency because I was really passionate about it. I had been working with the Chicago Osteopathic Cranial Study Group, and just my interest in it continued to grow. I also had done some OMT during residency on patients here and there, and continued to have good success with it. So I continued to really enjoy doing manipulation and treating people with manipulation, especially friends and as well. And so as I looked at different fellowships past residency, none of them appealed to me as much as doing manipulation. So I reached out and a friend recommended the program with Dr. Stiles, and I just applied and then I got in. The takeaways, Dr. Ed Stiles and Dr. Laura Griffin are phenomenal educators. They're both very passionate about their work. Also, I worked with Dr. Jennifer Kingery there, also phenomenal and very passionate. I found that second residency to be more therapeutic and healing than I expected. When I was at Rush, it was a group of private physicians at Rush that did the physiatry program. And I did not feel that they were as invested in my education as much as Dr. Stiles, Dr. Griffin, and Dr. Kingery and the rest of the staff in Pikeville. And I really, really liked the environment and the community and the supportive qualities of the people at that program. So yeah, those are some of the takeaways that I got. And I also developed a lot closer friendships with the people at the Pikeville program than I did in the physiatry program, which I, you know, that having that sense of community is powerful. It's important. And feeling connected is a big part of how people maintain a sense of health and well-being. Feeling connected is an important part of health. So,
yeah. What does Ed Stiles mean to you as far as an OMT mentor? You know he's going to listen to this.
Oh, absolutely. I really, really enjoyed working with Dr. Stiles. He is amazing. He was always passionate about it. He was always excited about it, and continues to be excited about it. And that's very motivating. I have to say, my skills continue to improve all the time. I think that's one of the most exciting things about OMT is that you put your hands on people, and as you grow as a physician, as you grow as a person, I've learned to listen better with my heart, listen better with my hands, and listen better with my head. And nothing connects me more to patients than putting my hands on them. And I think Ed Stiles really demonstrated that consistently and profoundly. He was always excited about finding the health and helping the patients recover and marveling at how amazing the body is. And it's contagious. Like, I definitely caught it from him. If I didn't have it before, I caught it from him, and it just continued. And it continues to my work with patients this day.
Yeah. The body, and well, the human person is so interesting. And yeah, every day, every patient that, maybe not every patient, but each day I am more in awe, you know, as I work with people. Yeah. Dr. West, we've been going for an hour. Anything else that you would like to mention that you haven't mentioned already?
No, but I do want to revisit just real quickly, you know, just as you asked that last question, you know, to go back and mention the difference between, you know, doing physiatry and OMT.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, well, I appreciate having my physiatry knowledge. You know, the more I learn to listen with just my hands, the more I just learn. And so we have an amazing ability to listen with our hands. And I think that's really, really, really underestimated in medicine. I think drugs are very seductive in the sense of, here's a medicine. I know the molecule that what this molecule does. I know what receptor it affects. And that knowledge feels very seductive. But we also, well, we might know that one pathway. We don't know all the other pathways that those pharmaceuticals are activating or deactivating. And that's, I think, where some of the many of the side effects come in. It's what we don't know about the drugs that we're prescribing. But with manipulation, we're doing amazing things. And the more we learn from people like Dr. Willard, the changes that just touch can do by manipulating fascia, by helping proprioception, by manipulating the joint. It's amazing. The body has so much potential to help itself. We couldn't do anything if the body didn't have such an amazing ability to self-correct. And so, yeah, I think when we look at, you know, physiatry or OMT, OMT has really helped me grow and connect with my patients more than physiatry ever did. And I am so appreciative of that.
And you think that's because of that empathetic touch?
Well, any touches, when you're touching a patient or you're working with a patient, you have to really listen. And I say the word listen, but I was in an osteopathic study group this weekend, and we really talked about being, you know, activating or listening through our efferent system. So letting the patient's body tell us through our fingers what tissue needs to change, and listening with our hands, listening with our heart too, because sometimes, you know, what they're telling us about their life is, you know, their cortisol levels are super high because of all the stress they're under. Or, you know, listening with our head about, I guess, their life situation, or, you know, a different type of stress, emotional stress, physical stress, and deciding on treatment plans. So really, I think to look at I just feel like listening with our hands is one of the most powerful things we can do. And it not only does it add, it gives patients a sense of safety when they get touched in a therapeutic way.
Yeah. I feel like that therapeutic touch is almost potentiating the inherent healing capacity of the body, like making it kind of sparking it to life.
Have you listened to the journal club between Peter Attia and Andrew Huberman?
I haven't, no, but I need to.
So it just came out like a week or two ago, and I happened to listen to it this weekend. And Huberman presents this paper where, I mean, just basically, it comes down to, they gave people nicotine, and they told all of them that they got a high dose, a low dose, or a medium dose. And then they put them in a functional MRI machine, and they graded their ability to do tasks, both physical and mental tasks. And all the patients who got the high dose of nicotine performed better. But in reality, all the patients got the same dose. The patient's ability, or the patient's belief, allowed their brain, their belief that they got a higher dose, it affected their ability to perform consistently, making their performance better than all the other, than the patients who thought they got a moderate dose of nicotine or a low dose of nicotine. But that the patient's belief changed their ability to function. And so when you talk about that therapeutic touch potentiating healing, I think you're right on track. When a patient believes through touch that you're more invested in them feeling better, and you are not just prescribing a drug, but you're actually touching them and helping them feel better, they believe they have that they're getting more, and that belief itself is a powerful activator of the health, activator of their ability to heal. But if you listen to that, the patient's belief about the dosage they got of nicotine really changed how much they, how well they performed.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to that mind, body, spirit connection, right? The power of our mind over even function, you know?
Exactly. And so I think we're just scratching. I mean, I think that our ability to believe is prefrontal cortex. That's a powerful part of our brain, right? That's our personality. And yet it changed the function of the rest of the brain. So,
yeah, it's incredible. Dr. West, you threw out some incredible pearls, clinical pearls and knowledge bombs tonight, and I really, really appreciate it. Any plugs that you would like to make?
I would encourage people to read the books I mentioned, listen to those podcasters. They have amazing perspectives. They're really helping people understand health. Your patients are going to start listening to these. So being as informed as you can, being gentle with yourself so that when you can't go home and listen to a podcast and you just need to just relax, give yourself the space to do that and take care of yourself so that you can be there for your patients.
Great. Thanks so much, Dr. West. If people have questions or would like to follow up with you, is it okay that I include your email in the show notes?
Yeah. Yes, you can.
Great. Are you going to be at Convo this March?
I plan to, yes.
Okay. Well, then I will most likely see you then.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
Hey, thanks, Dr. West. Have a great evening. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for sharing your career trajectory, comparing and contrasting OMM and physiatry. That was really interesting to hear your perspective on that. And the book recommendation, the podcast recommendations were spot on. I really, really appreciate that.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure, Ben. Good luck, and look forward to seeing you at Convo.
Okay, sounds good. Have a great evening. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Hope you enjoyed our conversation and learned more about hospital OMM versus private practice OMM. as well as the differences between OMM and PM&R. If you would like to reach out to Dr. West, you will find his email in the show notes, tonyfizz@gmail.com. Please reach out with any questions, comments, or if you would like to be on the podcast at onmmpodcast@gmail.com, and stay tuned for the next episode.